You look so tired. Why don't you go get some sleep?
Oh, no, I feel great. I feel great. Listen, I've been thinking. If you don't want me mixing with Creed no more, we'll make out some other kind of way, you know?
There's one thing I want you to do for me.
What?
Come here.
What?
Win. Win.
What are we waiting for? Take this!
Welcome to the 3-Minute Retrospective Podcast, Rocky Retrospective Series.
Now you're going to have to go through hell, worse than any nightmare that you ever dreamed. But in the end, I know you'll be the one standing.
Join Garrett.
Whatever he hits, he destroys.
Matt.
Seems like lately everybody wants to beat me up.
And Adam.
The ultimate male versus the ultimate meatball.
As they look at all the films starring that lovable underdog Rocky Balboa, as well as Ryan Coogler's continuation series, Creed.
Everybody in the audience better get ready for World War III.
From the 1976 Oscar-winning original.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Why do you want to fight?
Because I can't sing or dance. Hey, yo.
All the way through the Michael B. Jordan starring Creed films.
Your daddy died in the ring. This ain't no joke.
I don't know him. Ain't got nothing to do with me.
The three podcasting tomatas will dissect each film and seek to defeat each new opponent this franchise throws their way.
Come on, man. Come check this out. Hurry up.
Is your ring outside, podcast listeners?
Now you knocked him down. Why don't you try knocking me down?
Because the Percolated Media Rocky Retrospective begins now.
This is it, man!
Rocky, released December 3rd, 1976. Budget on this, oh my goodness, $960,000. Box office, everything combines about $225 million, although at the time of release, it made $117, which is a lot for 1976, and this was directed by John G. Avildsen. All right, well, 50 years. Matt, you are one who loves to do these series on anniversary dates. We kind of skipped it when Creed 3 came around. We thought about doing it with the previous co-host, but that once again fell through. Was the fact that this was 50 years, was that what made you decide to finally do it?
No, I had a different ulterior motive. I was just looking for content to do that would take up a considerable amount of time. And if you're going by numeric entries, this is one of the bigger outliers that you and I have never done. Mm-hmm. With 9 movies in total. So I figured it was as good a time as any, and I knew that you had done it at the old place, and I wasn't a part of those shows. So it's kind of doing this for the first time in a lot of ways. But I also think tying it into the 50th anniversary was an additional incentive specifically to do it this year. And I did look, November, they're doing a 4K re-release in theaters.
All right,
so
nice.
By the time these hit the airwaves, we'll be a little, probably a couple months away. So by the time we're done with this retro, it'll probably be time for people to go see this in theaters.
You talk about a movie that started from nothing, became pop cultural phenomenon, caught on, ended up winning 3 Academy Awards. Adam, is it safe to say, because we grew up with this series, that this is one of the most important movies in history, right?
I think it really is, not just for what it means, the people that have the longevity with it, but I think the story that's told in this movie is as important for this movie and what this movie is, because this movie really shouldn't have been made. This movie itself is an underdog, everything that has to do with it. And you look at everybody that's in it, everybody who's better because of it, and it's pretty damn amazing. This is one of those movies that when you look at the franchise as a whole, this thing takes a gigantic swing later on that just shifts the trajectory of it, and it becomes a drama to just a quick little action movie to then back to a drama piece. This series kind of runs the gamut and goes to all four corners of the ring.
Yep. The first one obviously came out the year before I was born, so I did not see this in theaters. I did not see number two in theaters. I didn't see number three in theaters. However, I did make it a point to see number four in theaters, and everyone after that, with the exception of five, I have seen in theaters. And this was something that... Boxing was popular. You had Muhammad Ali out there. You had Larry Holmes beating Muhammad Ali. You had a lot of things happening around this time. But I was such a huge fan of boxing that there was a time, and Adam, I think you remember this, I would watch all of these fights from all these movies. And at the time, there were only four of them in a row, like made it like a night of boxing. You know, I watched the four big Rocky fights in a row. This is a huge series for me. I had the boxing glove set. I had the Mr. T Clubber Lang standee. I was heavy into Rocky to the point where I would always play the themes when I would work out and things. And it had a huge impact on me and a lot of underdog white kids growing up back in the 70s and 80s. Now, Matt, Rocky Balboa had come out around the time you were a teenager, but you didn't really experience the original series. You came in pretty much during the Creed series, right?
I came in specifically with the first Creed. I saw Creed before I ever saw Rocky.
Oh, interesting.
Because Rocky is a movie that I know... Or I should say, I knew without ever having seen it.
Yeah, understood.
And to be honest, that's kind of why I didn't... It's not that I didn't care. I just felt like, you know, because it's a sports franchise, I know how they end in most instances. And it's one of the most famous movies ever made. So I kind of purposely steered clear of it and always told myself mentally in my checkbox that I had seen it without ever actually sitting down and doing it. But part of it's also, I'm not a boxing guy. I grew up... Post the heyday of boxing, I grew up at a time where when Mike Tyson lost to Buster Douglas, that was, you know, big for a lot of people, but not for me. And it's never been a sport that I've ever followed in any capacity. So as someone who loves sports movies as a genre, and ironically, I like boxing movies a lot, especially by directors I don't even like. Like, I really like Cinderella Man.
I was going to say, Cinderella Man, really? Like, you hate...
I'm not a Ron Howard fan, but I really like that movie. I liked Southpaw with Jake Gyllenhaal beyond just the obvious reasons of him with his shirt off. There's the, you know, both versions of The Champ I like a lot. But, you know, this is the... What Jaws is for shark movies, Rocky is for boxing movies.
Adam, what about you? Did you grow up loving the Rocky series? I know you and I, at some point, we have had at least one or two Rocky marathons when we were friends together. Were you a huge Rocky guy growing up?
I was. And I think the first time I was introduced to this movie was, or the series, was Rocky III. And the reason was, there was never a pay-per-view my family didn't watch for wrestling. We got together to watch WrestleMania with this newfound pay-per-view type of scenario, and WrestleMania 2, and Rocky 3 was such a big thing because Hulk Hogan was going to be in it. So we had to watch Rocky 3. And then from then on, it's just iconic. Those of us that lived through the Reagan 80s, you know, in the Cold War, Rocky 4 was to Americana what Top Gun was to military recruitment. You know, it's almost a propaganda film. And then later on, just appreciating movies, getting into it that way. And then during workouts, and when I would cycle and do, you know, hours long trainings, I would have the audio playing where I could listen to it along. So this was, I had a gym in my apartment, and I would just pop in one mic because I had the 5-box VHS tape. And I would pop in a tape wherever it was, work out for an hour. And then just whenever it was time for the next one, I would just continue it on from there. So Rocky has kind of always been synonymous with just existing as it went along. And that started with 3, 4 was, you know, that pop culture phenomenon. And then from a cinematic and cinema lover standpoint, I think you reevaluate some of these other ones and the movie making part of it starts to really affect you as well.
Now, Rocky... Like a lot of movies we've discussed, you know, we with Star Wars, with the making of Jaws, its making has been very well documented. So I'm not going to get too far into this.
But it's also like, not to cut you off, those three movies, each one, 75, 76, 77.
Yeah.
These three movies are the backbone of really American cinema in so many ways in that shift. You can't tell the story of American movies without touching on all three of these movies in a row. And this is the one that's sandwiched in between. You got one that's about a killer shark. You got one that's an epic space fantasy. And in the middle, you got the rags to riches, the most stripped down and authentic one of the three. But like I said, you can't tell the history of movies without us.
And what's going to be really fun about going through this series is it really leans on the shoulders of its star, right? And where its star, Sylvester Stallone, is at that particular time of his career. Matt, when you and I did Nightmare on Elm Street years ago, we talked about the fact that when New Line had hit a lull with their projects, they turned on the Freddy machine and they would put out a new Freddy film to kind of get them back up in the green. And Sylvester Stallone's career does the same thing. You can really make a comparison, and we will when we get into the films, of every single movie representing where Sylvester Stallone is at that particular time in his career. Matt, would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I'd also compare this to Stallone is a lot like Harrison Ford, where he's got two iconic franchises and two iconic characters. He's got Rambo and Rocky. Ironic that they both start with R, in the same way that Harrison Ford had Han Solo and Indiana Jones. And the amazing thing also is that they both continued to play the character without, and we'll talk about this in the years to come, without hiding the fact that they aged. Like, they embraced the humanity of these characters, and I really think that's why Rocky has had the legs that it's had for so long, because they've been able to make him relevant. They've been able to take the franchise in a new direction with him still as an integral part. Now, the difference also is that Stallone would get behind the camera in a way that Harrison Ford never did, although Mark Hamill has a great quote about Harrison Ford. He said, I think he'd make a really good director if he weren't so lazy. I think he said that in all sincerity. I think he meant that in all sincerity. But yeah, you know, I don't get the sense that, like, that Rocky, I think Rocky is Stallone's 1A and Rambo's his 1B, in the same way that I think Ford likes Indy much more than he likes Han Solo. To me, this is clearly the more passion-based franchise for Stallone, in large part because of how involved he got. It was, as the making ofs all talk about, and like you said, we're not going to get into it, it's his baby in every instance.
I think much like that other R franchise, you start with a movie that is telling a dramatic story in one direction that as the sequels happen, it completely changes into something else. And for a industry that does not like to see things age, that's how they've been able to keep things fresh without just recasting and rebooting, is, you know, you change the type of movie without changing the movie.
What's going to be really fun about going through this series is, and Adam, you've already touched on it, but we're going to discuss so many different things. We're going to talk about Hulk Hogan. We're going to talk about the Cold War ending by Rocky. We're going to talk about Tommy Morrison. We're going to talk about Dolph Lundgren yet again this year. We're going to talk about future Academy Award winners Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan. This series hits so many different notes, and it's really interesting to go through and see where cinema is at the time each movie is released, because I am here to say, and Stallone would be the first to agree, he made this first movie without any sequels in mind.
Absolutely. I think this was made not only without sequels in mind, I think the production company made this movie without Stallone in mind for the future. Yes. As well. But yeah, this was a one shot. This movie's not about boxing. This movie is about Sylvester Stallone trying to become an actor. That's what's here. I mean, it's about so many, you know, you can put that for anything, you know, oh, this is anybody trying to reach for that golden idol. But that's what this movie is to me.
I think the tagline of this movie, his whole life was a million to one shot, is one of the most self-reflective taglines you'll ever see for a movie. Not only does it perfectly encapsulate the story that we're about to talk about, but at the same time, it's Stallone's passion for getting this movie made. I think that's why also the character is impossible to distinguish from the actor, and without being a criticism of his performance, but they're so like joined at the hip because there's so much of him in the character he played for so long. And yeah, also remember, nobody was thinking about the F word in the 70s. It wasn't until you got to the 80s when that sort of became much more prevalent, and Rocky's success that launched from this movie gave them, pardon the pun, the credence to get more made.
So, Sylvester Stallone, down on his luck, sees a fight between Muhammad Ali and Chuck Wepner. He was really taken by that fight, as a lot of people were around that time, of Chuck Wepner. He had Ali in trouble a few times in that fight. And up until Buster Douglas came and knocked Tyson's ass out, he was like the biggest underdog going into that fight. And Stallone was taken by this. And with the support of his wife and the dog that is in this movie, you know, that he lived in this little rundown apartment, he whipped out this script in about 3.5 days is what he says. And he did some rewrites of it. Henry Winkler does say that he took it to network people and they were interested in doing it on TV, but Stallone was way against that. The only company that bit was United Artists. They loved the script. They said they would do it without Stallone in the lead. The stars they wanted were Robert Redford, Ryan O'Neal, Burt Reynolds, and James Caan. Matt, if that's not an encapsulation of 70s cinema, I don't know what is.
Nope, and quite frankly, I could see a lot of those other people in this role.
Absolutely.
I think Caan in particular. Like, if you've told me to pick someone, he's probably the one I would have put my money on.
And that was exactly one of the notes I had. You know, of all the people they wanted, I think Caan would work for this, and you could have that. And it's... all that does, though, especially based on who else is in here, it makes me go back to The Godfather. And for somebody who's trying to break away from that lineage, I understand the producers wanting to tie into something that is so revered by having some of those people in this one here. But yeah, for something that is such late 70s cinema, to get those people in this one, it would have worked. But I do think, other than the star, I think this thing is cast pretty perfect.
Well, Matt said it perfectly earlier, when he said that the tagline of this movie is the perfect personification of this movie, and that the star is like the biggest underdog, right? I don't think having that background behind it would have made the movie as powerful as it ends up being, despite the fact that James Caan, over the years, and we'll discuss it with Misery in a few years, he has done some really good performances, but I don't know if I could see him as an underdog. I can see him as the hard-nosed underdog, but Matt, do you think he could have been that sympathetic?
Yes. But I think also the character would have been a little bit harder edged. I really think if Caan played it, he would have been a mix of Rocky and Pauly. I could see that Rocky being much more less even tempered and possibly having a substance issue like Pauly. I think Caan would have recontextualized the character a bit.
Man, is Pauly I didn't realize. Holy shit, is he an unsympathetic character? We'll get to him.
Yeah, it's so funny, like, when you look at the trajectory of these characters from movie to movie. Like, as we'll talk about, he's a different character in every movie.
So, Stallone whips out the script, and it becomes a success. We'll talk about the Academy Awards here in a bit, but I do want to mention real quick that Chuck Wepner did sue Stallone after this movie had come out and became a huge hit, but they ended up settling for an undisclosed amount, so I guess Wepner was looking for every penny he could, right, Adam?
Yep, Hollywood's gonna Hollywood.
Yeah. Movie becomes an unexpected hit. And if you look at, I watched a trailer for this, and it's talking about the fact that Stallone is being compared to Marlon Brando, and it is being looked at for an Academy Award, and it starts gathering steam, and then it goes to the Academy Awards. And Matt, I know you love going through these. Let's go ahead and go through the Best Picture nominations that year.
Yeah, this is an insane lineup. We talk about nowadays how the Oscars struggle to fill 10.
Uh-huh.
Listen to the five that you're about to read.
Here we go. So Rocky, obviously, number one, ends up winning. But your other nominees are All the President's Men, Bound for Glory, Network, and Taxi Driver. Those are your nominees. Once again, Scorsese left out in the dust by an underdog, so to speak. Matt, what do you think about that?
Rocky's not the movie I would have picked, but I also understand why it won. Because the Oscars are a big dog and pony show, and they love celebrating the underdog as well. So I can understand picking that, because I could totally see a huge portion of the Academy that saw Taxi Driver and admired the craft in it and the storytelling, but because of the title character, they couldn't, and that some of the implications and themes of what the movie may be trying to say to a certain demographic, not voting for it based on that principle. And I think All the President's Men didn't win because of the political connotations that were associated with the movie's story. And you could argue the same thing about Network. Mm-hmm. And Bound for Glory is kind of eh. I think that's a distant fifth in this slate. But look, I'm not mad. I think Rocky was a deserving winner, but I don't think, if I had a vote, I would not have picked.
I don't think you could have had a bad winner in that bunch. I mean, geez, it's amazing that it took until The Dark Knight for them to decide to expand the categories. Really? Jesus. I mean, I'm sorry, but All the President's Men, Network. I mean, look, I love Rocky, but it's almost the safe choice at that point, which is crazy to say because this movie takes a lot of balls to get made and do what it does.
Well, the Academy, Matt's right. It hasn't changed in 50 years, and it just goes off of what, you know, it does its own thing, right?
And let's not forget, it's marketing. The Academy Awards is just marketing.
Yes, and Taxi Driver is such a fucking dark story that I don't know if you would want to put that out as a Best Picture winner.
Scorsese, he's got to have just pissed off some people.
Yeah,
down there, because for as long as that dude had to live without the recognition, there's people that must smile to his face and just hate that son of a bitch.
I think that's why he made Raging Bull.
I was just about ready to say, that's why 6 years later he would do, yeah.
4 years later.
4 years later.
Like, he made arguably, we'll talk about if Rocky is like the best boxing movie, but I think Raging Bull has the clear advantage in how the boxing scenes are shot, because Jake LaMotta throws a jab.
All right. We're getting to that already. Let's start getting into the movie. We start off with a side scroll that says Rocky as we get the beginning strings of a theme that, Adam, is it safe to say this is one of the most motivating movie themes of all time?
Yeah. Okay. So a couple weeks ago, I went and saw Top Gun in theaters for its 40th anniversary. And as I leave the theater, of course, what do? I bring up the Top Gun soundtrack, and that's what I'm blasting on the way home. This is the other soundtrack that I have always played when I need to pump me up, when I need to feel good, when I'm exercising, when I'm doing something. The theme, the score, the songs, and those are all very different, really are iconic throughout this entire franchise. And I use that word carefully and honestly, because I think that you hear that theme, you can have almost no experience with the movie. You know what it is.
I had the record album of every single soundtrack up through 4. And I would put those on, and I would have my wrestling ring. And we talked about this with He-Man as well. But I would take like certain wrestlers, and I would make them into characters from these movies and reenact the fights as they were going on with the themes in the background. It resonated with me as well.
I'm not going to criticize. I think the soundtracks and the scores of these movies are as important as the boxing matches themselves, to the point where I think they're kind of indistinguishable. Like, this is, removing the Bill Conti theme from this would be like taking the da-da out of Jaws. Like, it loses a lot of its power. And look, I'm glad we finally get a movie where we could praise Bill Conti, because I feel like the only times we talk about him were like the Bond movie, Free Rise Only, which that score is horrendous. and I think we've done a couple other movies he's done that aren't.
Yeah, he masters the universe.
Yeah. And every time we've been waiting to get to this one to give him love.
Yes. Yeah, we'll do Karate Kid eventually.
We then cut to a slow reveal of a mural of Jesus, as we see the date is November 25th, 1975 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We then cut to two fighters who, well, Matt, this isn't the best of techniques, is it? This style of fighting.
Yeah, this is one of the things where you can tell these are movies that are made by people who like boxing but don't necessarily understand the technique of it, because the most unreal, like, Star Wars is more realistic than Rocky in the sense that we this is a world where people can become the heavyweight champion of the world without throwing a jab whatsoever. Like, if you're a fan of like technique and boxing in and of itself, you almost have to laugh at these fights. Now, they get by because they're movies, and it's about the impact, it's about the oomph, it's about the physicality that's presented. But if you're like a fan of the sport, I could see you just laughing at this.
Yeah, agreed. And that's where it's rough. Well, I can't really say anymore, because there is, thanks Paul Family, there is almost no boxing like anymore that exists. But I loved boxing, especially in the 80s, you know, and not just the obvious heavyweight, you know, with Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield and some of that stuff. But I grew up with my dad watching Sugar Ray Leonard. So just the sweet science was something. And I know you did too. Like, we got together for those and it was great. So to watch these people just basically fast forward 5 movies and turn into a street fight, but inside of a squared circle, it's not the best. But I do think at the beginning, it almost shows that these are just club fighters. These are just club fighters in a dirty, smoke-filled, you might as well put this in a bar, and these guys just duking it out. But yeah, this is for people who don't know boxing.
Adam, remember, my birthday was in November, and every November they would have a boxing pay-per-view, and I would get, my parents would let me get it and have a big get-together every year. Those were always fun. And yeah, you know, I'm going to excuse it for this movie because I do think it fits the Rocky style, right? Like, Rocky is supposed to not have a great technique.
But in hindsight, though, with that logic, it makes Apollo Creed look worse.
That's what I was getting to. Yeah, when we get to the bigger fights, I'll definitely have criticisms.
Yeah, I think it's fine here because it's like a gym where it's clear, like, Rocky, he talks about, like, I had no one helping me. I learned by doing.
Uh-huh.
But it's also counterintuitive because of the thought of being boxing was tremendously popular in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I know John Avildsen, this is his biggest movie for his career, basically. And this poor bastard lost two jobs. You know what movies he got fired off of?
Yes, because we had him in on an editing session on one of our films, and I did talk to him about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, so he got fired from Serpico and Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, two little nothing movies.
Yeah,
it's like... But he got this as, you know, this is sort of like Rocky lost the fight, but he gets the girl at the end. You know, he got the Oscar, and neither of those other two movies did. But, you know, this is far and away his, like, that's not a movie he directed, everybody, stop. But this is his biggest success.
Until, like, The Karate Kid. I think The Karate Kid almost matched it, right?
No, well, I'm talking about, like...
Gotcha.
If you're a film buff, like, Rocky is such a part of American cinema.
Gotcha.
The Karate Kid is to a certain demographic. I can't believe that property's still going.
Yeah.
But, you know, because unlike, you know, he directed this one and he'll direct a future installment.
Mm-hmm.
He directed all three original Karate Kid movies.
Yep.
But yeah, Avildsen, I think, does a, we'll talk about in this movie, I think his directing work is pretty comparable.
Very. And one of the nicest guys on the planet. I remember... His son had actually seen a cut of our film, and he said, do you want me to get my dad to give you some advice on it? And we were like, fuck yeah, and gave the best advice, and we gave him a special thanks at the end because he was just a remarkable man. Rest in peace. So Rocky is kind of getting pummeled as there is some clinching going on, and Stallone tells a funny story when he was on Conan O'Brien one time, and he told a funny story where, do you guys remember the Rocky video game that came out? I think it was for PS1, maybe PS2.
There's a bunch of them, I know that.
And he would play as Rocky, and his son would play as Spider Rico, the character in this fight. And his son would beat the fuck out of him in that video game. This is funny to have him tell that story. But here he is.
Does that game disable the X button that so you can't throw a jab?
You know what I love about this too, like you said, Matt, boxing was so popular, but you have these arenas here that were so smoky, like everybody's smoking a cigarette here.
Yeah, this is the boxing equivalent of ECW because it's in Philadelphia. It's a bunch of, like, bloodthirsty fans because you get that woman saying, like, hit him again.
Or, yes.
She does everything but say, give him the chair. Like, these are ravenous fans who can't afford the big, like, bicentennial fights, but they love boxing. I think they just love they're just bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
But I like that we're seeing that it's such a part of Americana at this time that it's, like, even the low-tier, uneducated type of boxing is still drawing crowds.
So Rocky gets some water in the corner as he comes out. And once he comes out, Spider headbutts him, and Rocky just loses it, completely unleashes on him, and the bell is called as his hand is raised in victory. And Matt, you mentioned this woman. I love her, too. Like, she's just yelling, you're a bum, on the way out. And I guarantee she went to every one of his fights later on, you know? Like, she's one of those types of fans.
It's the female Pauly sitting here excited.
So he goes in the locker room, cigarette in mouth, by the way, and sits next to Spider, who tells Rocky that he got lucky, which means he only earns about $40 when all is said and done. Boy, that's easy to live on, huh? Jesus Christ.
And it's that kind of... To me, this is when I... And again, I'll say this probably a bunch more, but anybody who wants to make this an allegory for their life, you know, yes, that's what it is. And hey, have you ever been a background actor? Guess what? That's the reality of the day. Mm-hmm. 16 hours and you got a meal and $20.
Yeah. I do like this, though, because, like you said, Adam, these are the two people who just pummeled each other in the ring, and here they are sitting next to each other, and they're getting paid, like, in front of each other, you know? Like, we're seeing the realities of it right here, and I really like that.
Yeah, pay attention to Spider Rico.
Taz and Sabu.
Yeah, yep. Said, pay attention to Spider Rico. Remember that name.
Oh, yeah, we'll see him again.
I can't hear Spider without thinking of Goodfellas.
We then cut to Rocky walking the streets as his hanger-on brother sings in the background and trains are going by.
Frank Stallone.
Frank Stallone, always a fun interview. He was great. Like, Stern would have him on, and every time he was on, it would always make me laugh. Rocky gets to his apartment, which isn't in the best of conditions, as he takes a swig of liquor and he says hi to Cuff and Link, the turtles. Pay attention to them as well. He does say if they could sing and dance, he wouldn't have to be doing this. And he puts his hat on a rack and he starts talking to the turtle food and even looks at a picture of himself in the mirror. This set of shots here, I remember this mirror shot being in a lot of things, in DVD retrospectives and things. I just love getting to see Rocky in this life. I love being in this world. I think the way Avildsen shoots this, Matt, it's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Well, what I appreciate it and why this is could only have been made in the 70s is that Philadelphia is a character in this movie in the way that Scorsese utilized New York as a character. That you can't picture this taking place in anywhere. And they use the landmarks very well, of course, which is freaking art steps. Not since The Exorcist has a movie gotten this much mileage out of a set of stairs.
Right.
But it also does a good job of showing that the world that Rocky lives in, it encapsulates why he wants the big shot so badly, because it's such a contrast to what he lives in currently.
There is not a movie within a couple years after this that is going to take this amount of time to just set up and feel and place you in the world and take long shots of having a person walk down a street. This movie's not long, and these shots all could be half the length, and the movie would be worse for it. You just feel like you are here. You can smell that gutter. You can feel what that air smells like, you know, walking around the corner. It is, to Matt's point, as much of a character in this film as anybody else. It lives and breathes here like Scorsese does New York.
So Rocky grabs some ice to put on his head as he lays down, and then he heads to the pet store where Adrian is working. And man, is this character put upon. Very mousy in this movie.
Oh, she is one incident of being pushed out of a window to becoming Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns.
I'm telling you. She had come off of The Godfather, obviously, so she was a known actress. And you know what? For what she does here, look, Adrian becomes a different character by the end of this series, as does everybody. But I really do like seeing a little bit of an evolution throughout the course of this movie, of this character. Adam, how do you feel about Adrian here?
I think Talia Shire's casting is as important to this movie's success as almost anybody else's. And I don't say that lightly. I think she is great. Not good. I think she's great. The character evolution is a little quick. This might as well be a precursor for She's All That in the way that, you know.
Lord.
But she is absolutely astounding in this film.
You know, it's interesting because she to me in the first Godfather was always the weak link.
Yeah.
Now, I think she's a lot better in the second one, which is why she got nominated for that. So going to this, I was a little worried when I watched this for the first time because I had The Godfather. The first one is my frame of reference, but I think she is as important to this movie as Stallone in a lot of ways as far as keeping it grounded, because this character, with how she's presented physically, could have been played as bumbling, as like Christopher Reeve Superman trying to be Clark Kent. It could have been that. And as a result, you would have been questioning why would a tough, down-to-earth guy like Rocky be so smitten with her. But I think because she plays it down enough to match him while still having the glasses and being kind of mousy, I think that type of contrast works really well.
That is
and it's a surprise because it should not work.
Yeah, and I think what they're doing together, like, look, Stallone is fine in this. I'm not going to say he's bad. He's fine in this. I think when they're together, I do think she elevates his performance when they're on screen side by side.
And Matt, that is a tremendous point you make, in that the way she's portrayed here, it makes the fact that Rocky himself is taken by her that much more remarkable, because nobody else really sees in her what he does. And that's what makes the character even more unique.
Yeah, it's also the thing of, it's a contrast because he wants the fame or the opportunity at fame, but not the conventional trappings of like dating supermodels or things that come with that lifestyle. He sees the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And to Adam's point, I think Stallone is good in this, but I actually think he gives a better performance in the first Rambo movie.
First Blood, yep.
Yeah, although, you know what? We're going to talk about a very important scene that was almost not in this film later on.
Oh, yeah, the one that they had to argue to keep.
I think he's really good in this. I'm going to take it a step higher than you guys. I think he's tremendous in this, actually. So Rocky is completely taken by this mousy character, as we mentioned, and he's trying his best to sweet-talk her as Buttkiss, who is Stallone's real dog, barks from this cage. And Evelson, man, there's a shot here where he follows Rocky standing up and just looking, and it just captures everything about that character right there. Really nicely done shot. We then see Rocky go to his other job, which is collecting for Gazzo.
Yeah, he's working for the Corleone family. He's Luca Brasi's replacement.
Now, this is when we get into some interesting territory, because this job here, the set of scenes, it proves that Rocky has a heart of gold, as he just refuses to break this guy's fingers, even though he's short $70. He's being told by Gazzo, who is Joe Spinell, who is another pretty well-renowned actor at that time. He's being told to break his fingers, but Rocky's not doing that. Is this a little too devil with a heart of gold, Matt?
No, because you can be in that line of work, and, you know, because collecting money is different than being a hitman. I think that would have been, like, if he was hired to kill somebody and didn't do it, I would have found that to be too much of a contrast. But I think because he's collecting debts and you can rough people up to a certain degree, but he knows, pardon the pun, he knows when to pull his punches, I don't have an issue with this.
I think he at least should have left him with a black eye. I could see your point, but it was also very common that some of these people that had debts knew they weren't going to get limbs broken or else they couldn't earn the money. So it kind of fits. I do say I like Grazzo's inclusion in this. I think it fills out the world pretty nicely. I could do without his driver, who's just douche sakes, like, just, you know, muzzle him a little bit. But I like Grazzo.
Well, it's just ironic that he's also in the first two Godfather movies. Uh-huh,
exactly.
Yeah.
Grazzo, played by Joe Spinell, he gets his money and sets Rocky up with a new errand. Grazzo's driver asks if Rocky got the license number of the truck that ran over his face, as Grazzo gives Rocky a hard time for not breaking the thumb of the guy who was $70 short. So Grazzo's walking away, but he asks Rocky if he knows how to spell Del Rio. This is just setting Rocky up as just this guy who, he doesn't have a chance, does he?
Well, yeah, because life beats him down. Yes. Not just in the ring, like everybody, like this movie's all about people's like perception. And, you know, not judging a book by its cover, which I know that's like that's a Disney level of messaging. But I think because the movie is conceivably very grounded, which was the hallmark of the 70s for almost every like dramatic movie, it was important to be authentic, borderline method for a lot of people. Because this movie very easily could have been like Frank Capra level of sentimentality, where it feels almost fantastical. In the sense that, like, this could have been a very different movie and still been great. Because you could take this exact same plot, set it 20 years prior, and have a Jimmy Stewart or a Paul Newman play Rocky, or at least a Rocky type. And it would have been still good, but it probably would have been a lot more schmaltzy and crowd-pleasing in the sense that he probably would have won the fight at the end.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll definitely get there. And just to kind of piggyback what Adam said earlier, I do have to mention, and I love these shots of Rocky just walking on these rain and pollution-drenched streets of Philadelphia. It really puts you in the mind of the film.
Yeah, enough that you can almost, you know, I don't know, write a song called Streets of Philadelphia or something about it.
Rocky goes to the gym and sees that his locker's combination has changed, and the locker is now Dipper's. Dipper, by the way, will be one of Rocky's trainers later on. So Rocky goes to Mickey to ask him about it, and Mickey says that Dipper needed the locker because he's a contender, not a tomato like Rocky. He says that Rocky has heart, but he fights like a goddamn ape, and he hasn't even had his nose busted. Put a pin in that. All right, so here's Burgess Meredith. At this point, he's a well-respected actor. Darby O'Gill and the Little People is what I would have probably known him from. With the,
damn you.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man. Like, he was, that was like the only thing I knew him from. And then the Twilight Zone episodes, obviously. He is fucking great in this. He's another one who has an interesting character evolution in that he is really riding Rocky hard in this. Like, he's just telling him just how big of a loser he is and how good he could have been. But eventually, we'll talk about later on, but he eventually sees not just the opportunity to train somebody who's contending for a title, he's also sees the opportunity to make a little bit of money, which he hasn't won at this point. Matt, how do you feel about Burgess Meredith in this film?
As a Batman fan, you're breaking my heart that you didn't go.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He will always be the Penguin.
Oh, that's right.
for all intents and purposes. But yeah, I mean, one of the great celebrated actors. I mean, this is a guy who Otto Preminger used in like 13 movies. Like, it's insane. And getting him here, I think, was the studio's way of saying like, hey, Stallone, we need to surround him. You know, we need guys who can prep him up just in case he needs a little bit of heavy lifting. Because you can argue they kind of took a similar approach with some of Schwarzenegger's early movies. Because Stallone was untested in a lot of ways. Like, this was not... I could see, like, in a world, like, if First Blood came out first, maybe they wouldn't have felt the need to get a Burgess Meredith to be his literal corner man, but also a figurative one as far as the acting. But I like that Mickey is... He starts out as an opportunist in the way that, like, a lot of sleazy, like, he very easily could have been, like, Don King.
Oh, yeah.
And written that way, which is ironic given one of the future movies. But much like Rocky and a lot of the other characters, he has a real arc throughout these movies that I appreciate. And you can clearly track it.
Adam, how do you feel about Burgess Meredith in this?
I want to hug Matt for at least bringing us back around to Penguin. Jesus, Garrett. Again, without Mickey, I don't know if this feels as right as this does. Who do you put here? You can't do it. He's a little too contentious in this for me, but it feels right for this dirty-ass, hard-nosed Jim. How disrespectful that you're just going to put this guy's bag up on Skid Row and then talk shit about him right in front of the person that you gave his locker to. It's hard to endear yourself to Mickey right away. If you don't know what you know later on, you don't like Mickey. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a kind of a change for Burgess Meredith to be playing it that way, because he's not likable at the beginning. He's doing it amazingly well, but he's not likable.
But he played a lot of characters who were not likable. Like some of his Twilight Zone episodes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But like he kind of played the opposite of this in Magic the year later.
Oh yeah,
he plays like the good mentor, so to speak.
But it's when it comes to the casting agent, I don't know how many bodies they knew were buried, but to fill this out the way they do deserves its own special award.
And Lucas would take this approach as well the next year. You have Alec Guinness mentoring Mark Hamill in that. I love these characters that kind of come in and challenge our protagonists. And Mickey does that so well in this and in future movies. So Mickey tells Rocky to think about retiring. Rocky goes back to the pet store despondent and just unleashes all his problems to poor Adrian. God knows I have people who do this to me every night at my job. And as a worker, you just listen. Rocky talks to the birds, who he says look like flying candy. And then Rocky leaves and says that he'll return soon with another joke for her. But she's not really responding that much. We didn't see
Rocky. I was just going to say that the Mickey Burgess Meredith casting, you could also read this as a dig on. So he did 4 Twilight Zone episodes. The last one he did, which is Printer's Devil, where it's about the newspaper writer. It's revealed in that Burgess Meredith, who is the, I don't know if he's the editor or whatever, he's revealed to be the devil, and that the guy made a literal deal with the devil to get success. I like that his casting is kind of a wink and a nod to that, where you're questioning what's his ulterior motive.
We see Rocky go to the bar to look for Pauly, and everyone is asking how Rocky's fight went, and this is when we are introduced to Apollo Creed, and I feel this is a great way for us to meet him while he's on TV. This is Carl Weathers. You can obviously tell he channeled a lot of Muhammad Ali in this. It's definitely there. I don't know if Muhammad Ali was this big of a businessman as Apollo is proven to be in this, but man, Carl Weathers proved himself on this. I really like him as Apollo.
Amazing casting. Perfect way to portray Apollo Creed. I get some of that Muhammad Ali stuff out of him, but not so much that it's a parody or a ripoff. You know, I think he does bring his own level of charisma to it. You know, it's almost more of a, I guess, you know what? If you took Muhammad Ali and Lando Calrissian and put him in a blender, this is what you would get. And I absolutely love it. I really do. And it's amazing that he would get both of the major 80s action stars and get to play off of both of them with Arnold and Stallone. But he as Apollo is just iconic.
Matt, we reviewed him with Predator. You seem to have liked him then. How do you feel about
it? And Toy Story 4, so ironic that's right. we're doing transitions. I appreciate that he's an antagonist before he's an outright villain. Because I think in a movie that was... like a lesser movie or one that was made by like Frank Capra, he would have been just despicable Like, they would have had hitting bystanders or something like that. I like that he's all flash, but it's substance, which was the Muhammad Ali mantra. It's the, I'm good and I know it. Like, this is, I read a lot of superstar Billy Graham in this character.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of pro wrestling infusion. Even in this first movie, before the WWF became
when it was WWF.
Yeah, it was the WWWF.
Yeah.
But it's funny, this is kind of the precursor to how wrestling would be presented. And eventually, this franchise incorporated a lot of pro wrestling, literally and from a presentation standpoint. Mm-hmm. But it starts even in this first movie. Like, this is, you know, he's got some Ric Flair, he's got some Dusty Rhodes aspects. But I like that he's not the villain, per se. He's the obstacle, which also kind of makes this movie stand out from the rest of the series in a lot of ways.
All right, well, you mentioned the word despicable. That would bring us to our very next character we're meeting. We have Rocky asking Pauly about why Adrian isn't responding to his advances. And Pauly says that she's approaching 30 and is going nowhere in life. He then asks Rocky if Grasso's hiring. And Pauly tells Rocky to come by tomorrow and he'll see if he can set something up between the two. All right. So, man, Burt Young playing Pauly. What a fucking just despicable character.
You hate him, and that's intentional, because this is a character who has an issue that bubbles to the surface, and he has a coping mechanism, as we'll find out. But again, these feel like real people. You don't like him, but you have a certain degree of empathy for his lot in life. And again, much like Mickey and some of the other characters, like, he has a real evolution, although it's to the point where he doesn't feel like the same character from time to time. But in this first movie, again, I like that it's... If Scorsese wrote this movie, this would have been the character we probably would have followed. It would have been told through his perspective, because he's just pretty detestable.
Absolutely detestable character. Absolutely just piece of trash person. And you can't help but, I don't want to say love him, but you can't turn away from him. You know, he is captivating whenever he's on screen doing it. He is chewing scenery, but doing it in a way that's not hammy. This dude just feels like he grew up in these slums. And you hate him, but it feels right to hate him.
It's also important that they cast a guy who doesn't look like a movie star.
Definitely.
Like, so yeah. You don't have that. It's like you have a guy who's living in the slums, is an alcoholic and just self-loathing, but he looks like, I don't know.
Me.
Pick your 70s. pick your 70s, like, leading man.
Be so hard on yourself, Adam. You know what I think is a great example of writing by Stallone in this is the reason why we like Pauly is because Rocky likes Pauly. And if Rocky likes Pauly, there has to be some redeeming qualities about him. But we spend this entire movie, hell, this entire franchise, this entire series trying to find those redeeming qualities.
Yeah, but Rocky sees the good in everybody.
Yes.
That's why you as an audience member give these characters a chance, because he sees something in them that we clearly do not.
Great point.
You almost feel like these two have grown up together and gone through the shit together, mm-hmm. and it's all there. We don't need to see it, but you know that they've done it. They know what each other have done to get where they are, and it's not good, and they can still be there for each other.
I love how we end this scene, because we just see Apollo on the screen talking about how kids who want to be athletes, no, that's not the way to live. You got to be a thinker, not a stinker. Go to college. So
say your prayers, eat your vitamins, yeah.
and have your pasta mania, brother.
Buy my beer. Rocky then goes outside to grab Marie from the crew she was with. Put a pin in this chick. We'll see her again later on the series. He tells her to not.
I just thought of something. You know, like, if they really wanted to help out Stallone, you know who would have been Pauly? Nicholson.
See, Nicholson wouldn't have taken that though.
But yeah, and he would have overshadowed everybody. But like, if this was made 10 years prior, like if this came out the same time as Easy Rider, it would have been Nicholson
probably. He tells Marie not to smoke, as it makes your breath garbage, as he says. He says that if she keeps hanging around that crew, she'll turn into a whore, and they continue to walk and talk until she says goodbye by saying, "Screw you, creepo." Boy, that's some gratitude. Rocky does walk away telling himself, "Who are you to give advice?" So, almost 30 minutes in, we get our first real scene with Apollo, as he hears that Mac Lee Green's backing out of the fight and he needs an opponent. They go over, one guy after another, and they each have said 5 weeks isn't enough to get in shape to fight the heavyweight champion of the world. Apollo says this fight needs a novelty, so on January 1st, he's going to give an unknown the opportunity of a lifetime. His promoter agrees and says that it's very American, and Apollo corrects him and says no. It's very smart.
Because those two things can't be one and the same.
Yeah.
Because us Americans are fucking stupid.
You're not kidding. And this goes to what you say, Adam. I think Weathers is great here. I think he adds the business sense. And, you know, we're not going to see this promoter anymore in this series. This is the only movie we see him in. But he's just going against the advice. He wants to give an unknown the opportunity.
Yeah, oh, yeah, because... Oh, Juergens. Yeah, he's only in this one.
Yeah, Juergens is only in this one.
I keep conflating him with the...
Tony.
Yeah. Dude. Throw the damn towel!
Yeah, yeah.
What I like about this is it... Especially in that time frame, I think it shows some respect to boxers of being a little smarter than they would have been given credit for, especially black boxers, and especially those that were being used by promoters.
Good point.
So just on the surface, I think that is a really important way to depict the way that they do Apollo Creed.
So we go back to Rocky, who's getting his orders from Grasso, and he tells him that he's taking out Polly's sister. And then Buddy, who's this driver, tells him to take her to the zoo, and Grasso slips Rocky a few bucks and tells him to have a nice time with Adrian. Okay, so this is when we go back to Apollo. He's going over one opponent after another before landing on the name, the Italian Stallion. I don't think Apollo is taken by the person. I don't think he's taken by the fighter. He is taken by the name and how it's going to look on the poster.
Yeah, it's the branding. And it's also important they talk about the name sounds American in the prior scene, but he picks someone with Italian.
Yeah.
That's a very intentional choice on a writing perspective to put these back to back. Yeah, he's looking at it as the, like, how can I cash in on this and make the most? Because in his mind, he's not going to get challenged in a physical sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to make up for it in another way by building a mountain out of a molehill.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you look at him, Apollo's literally going through a book of fighters. He's just going name by name. All right, what's going to look good on a poster? How are we going to sell this on TV? He doesn't know what he looks like. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know anything about him. Duke does a little bit, you know, because he pays attention. But other than that, nah, that Italian Stallion. It looks so good. That's all he cares about. Because it's a show. There's nothing there except he's got to make sure he's getting his money.
In his mind, it's like a circus event. Like, come to the freak show. And it's all like about building the branding out of that.
He had a fight. You know, you could delay it, but he's not going to do that because then you missed opportunity. These are the type of things that happen nowadays in the boxing world. And you know that it's bullshit that somebody, injured their hand. No, they're just not ready. But this was legitimate, especially when you were trying, you know, you had already sold tickets. You had already had a place going. And this time frame is short. You know, trying to get somebody ready is 6 weeks for a fight. Yeah. Damn.
You mentioned Duke. He becomes one of my favorite characters of this entire series. And it starts here because everyone's like, yeah, yeah, we like that name. But Duke is the one who looks at Apollo and looks at Rocky and says, he's a southpaw. I don't like you messing with southpaws. They're dangerous. But Apollo's all about the branding, so he's going to go with it.
Yeah, I like how he's got someone to look at it from a logical standpoint. Yeah. It kind of foreshadows Apollo's Achilles heel in a lot of way when we get to the actual fight. Like, this is a through line that actually carries to the end. Like, that's not an unintentional thing to just acknowledge that he's a left-handed boxer.
Nope. We then cut to Rocky and Polly, who's still asking for a job. I feel like every time we go to Polly, I'm just going to start laughing. And Rocky,
you're going to do that by the time we get to some in a couple weeks. You're going to be like,
oh yeah,
having to hold your side. You're laughing if that's going to be your train of thought.
You're not wrong. Rocky once again spots Marie, who's once again hanging with the wrong crowd. Polly tells Rocky that Adrian's real excited about this date. And of course, Polly's proven to be a liar as she's not even looking at Rocky when he enters the house. She tells Polly that she's not ready for this. And Rocky is in the awkward situation of seeing this argument take place.
I just love this because the whole walk there, you sure she's excited? Oh, yeah, she's totally excited. She knows I'm coming, right? Oh, she can't wait. That's great. Freaking Polly's such an asshole.
I know. Rocky is once again seeing Apollo on the TV as Adrian says that she can't go because she has a turkey in the oven. How does Polly solve this? By throwing the turkey outside. But I love that he keeps the fucking drumstick and he's just chomping on it. Rocky says maybe they should forget about this as they're all in bad moods. But Rocky goes to the door and tells Adrian that he doesn't know what to tell a door. He doesn't want to spend Thanksgiving alone, so he'd like to spend it with her. And this is what gets her to come out, and we get a nice pull-in on Adrian as she gets ready in the mirror. That was a nice shot. So the two of them leave, and one thing I love about discussing these old films, boys, is how great moments are born out of necessity. They get to this ice rink. They didn't have it for that long. What happens as a result is one of the sweetest dates I've ever seen put on film.
This is such a great scene and a great moment. And yeah, the just the necessity of invention with what they had. It also happens in the finale of this film. And I got to say, you know, we talked about the direction a little bit. Talk about the writing, talk about the casting, talk about the score. This thing is directed so well. And it's a shame that we don't talk about this guy more with so many more films. I mean, we barely, we haven't talked about the, you know, Steadicam, which technically was not invented for this film. I know that's a great little, you know, false narrative, but it was perfected for this and really became not standard, but okay to use after this film. This scene is one of those where just these two around the ice rink, just talking. It's a 5-minute scene of them just, well, really of him just talking. And it's the sweetest little date. And you start to feel them both fall for each other. And she's happy to get there. She's doing these little, I mean, she's almost like just walking on the, you know, the ice. She can't really skate well. And it's so sweet and so well done. It's only the type of scene that you would have in a 70s movie or before. You would never do this today. But damn it, it works.
I thought of another reason why this beat Taxi Driver. The date here, it's cute, it's romantic. The date in that movie, he takes her to a porno theater.
Yeah, a little different.
But again, it's born out of necessity because they also couldn't afford to pay extras.
Nope.
Which is why it's also empty. Like Ed Wood would clap his hands watching this movie if he found that out. But sometimes, you know, it's like the shark in Jaws not working. You have to make do with what you have. And I think these little moments that on a big picture level, you could, if you're a producer, you could say, oh, cut this scene. But if you do, you remove a lot of the needed empathy. Because if you made this just a straightforward boxing movie, you'd lose some of that humanity aspect, which you need to care about the fight in and of itself. Like, you need to literally and figuratively prepare to build up to the fight in a way that a boxer physically would prepare. You got to put in the times that the fight means something.
Yeah,
which I think is what a lot of other, like the weaker boxing movies are the ones that do that, where they're so focused on the fighting and the physicality of it that the punches don't have any weight.
And this series falls into that trap as well. Rocky takes Adrian to his place, telling her that she's shy by nature, and Rocky makes clear that her being shy doesn't bother him at all. Adrian is still not understanding why Rocky wants to fight, and he says the worst thing about it is the morning after. Rocky is bragging about how his nose has never been broken. I love how they keep bringing this up. Because later on, it's going to pay off. Rocky invites her in, and she's apprehensive about it. But as always, Rocky is able to sweet-talk her in. She makes her way in, and Rocky is asking if she wants anything as he turns on some music. He shows her the turtles that she sold him, and he invites her over to sit down. She makes her way over as she points out the pictures that Rocky was looking at earlier. Rocky says he doesn't have a phone and says that if he wants to call her brother, he can help her with that. So he yells out the window that Adrian is just fine. He asks Adrian what the problem is, and she says that she doesn't belong here, and she doesn't know him well enough to be here in his apartment. She says that she doesn't feel comfortable, and he begs her not to go. He takes off her glasses, compliments her eyes, then he takes off her hat, telling her that she's very pretty. He then leans in to kiss her, saying that she doesn't have to kiss back if she doesn't want, and they end up making out a bit. This, in hindsight, is kind of uncomfortable to watch. I think it's meant to be very sweet, and it kind of does come off as sweet, but Adam, yet another scene you couldn't do in 2017 and on, could you?
Absolutely not. It's tough because am I supposed to criticize this scene? Yeah, I am. Am I supposed to say that he's, you know, acting a little predator-ish? I'm supposed to, but that's not how it plays. That's more how it looks. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a time frame where it was kind of expected that it's the whole, oh, no, I can't do that. He doesn't feel like a predator. He doesn't feel like Paulie. And I think if Adrian flat out was just like, no, I don't think he would force the issue. So I don't think it's that. Watching it, though, you can feel the, I understand why people would not be comfortable with this scene. I understand that.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that she's not resistant to it kind of removes me being able to criticize it. There is a certain amount of consensual, and it's also kind of borderline awkward in the way that, like, first kisses are done in teenage, like, rom-coms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, and like I said, this is nowhere, like, this is not Stranger Danger, this is not stalker territory. I don't think that's something you can actively criticize. But it's also the thing of, like, yeah, your perception, you think it's wrong, but this movie's all about how perceptions can be distorted.
Him putting his hand up to stop her, yeah, okay, I can agree with that. But it's her also learning to feel comfortable with herself as a woman by the end of this film, I think is something that's here that's not explored because of who's making this film.
And I definitely think they consummate the relationship here. I seriously think they fucked right after this.
For sure. Oh yeah, sure. I don't think he answered the 10 count.
Well played, sir. We cut to Rocky going back to the gym as he's being told that Mickey is looking for him. Mickey points out that someone from Creed's camp is here looking for him, and Mickey says the reason he's been sticking it to Rocky since he's been coming here is that he sees potential in him, but instead he's made a waste of life breaking legs, as he says. So we cut to Jurgens. He shows up, and I like how Rocky is asking for the stationery. Like, he wants this business card to kind of take as a memento of this meeting. Jurgen tells Rocky that he has a proposal for him, and Rocky says that he's available to spar with the champ as he assures that he won't take any cheap shots at him. But Jurgens makes it clear that he's looking for Rocky to be Apollo's opponent, and Rocky is seen turning it down. Jurgens says that America's the land of opportunity, and that Apollo picked him as the unknown with the shot of a lifetime, and he can't pass it by. Rocky turning this down. Matt, is this just because he just doesn't see himself being worthy of the championship?
Yeah, I think it's that, and it's also like he's not clearly not interested in the material aspects that would come with the fight initially. Like, that's not foremost on his mind. And I think in his mind, he also thinks it's kind of like a deluded fantasy. Mm-hmm. That maybe he's reading it as, oh, I'm just like a sheep being led to the slaughter, and this is kind of like a glorified con job. Because he's ignorant in certain aspects, but he's not a moron, as we'll find out in these movies.
Yeah, Matt, I kind of hit exactly one of my notes where, like, he's simple, but he's not stupid. Look, he says it earlier, and he means it. The reason he does this is because he can't sing or dance. This is what he can do. And this guy's the epitome and the best of what this world is. And he doesn't belong there with them. He can't. I mean, that's such an idol, such a fantasy. Like, all he would do is insult him being in the ring on TV. I'll spar with him. I'll make him better. But he doesn't feel like he deserves to be there. And I think it's a good character piece. Very good.
We cut to Rocky watching the news conference with Adrian and Paulie, and Apollo was running his mouth as always, and we're getting some sound bites like the irony of him fighting a white man on the biggest night of his life. And Rocky says that Creed's the best, so he's going to try his best, and we're even hearing an origin story on the name Italian Stallion, and Rocky makes it a point to say hi to Adrian on TV. Sweet moment there.
That is so great.
I loved it. But Paulie's angry. He's angry at the cheap shots that Apollo's taking at him, and then asks Rocky if Paulie can help train him. Adrian says that Rocky has a good chance, and Paulie is upset and tells her to get out of his life. See, things were great when, well, not great, but when Paulie was the breadwinner, he was not this contentious with Adrian, but now there are people with higher status than him, so it kind of upsets him.
Yeah, he feels threatened that he's now not the sole male provider, or even really the sole male in her life. You know, it's kind of that older brother protective aspect that, not that you feel threatened, but it's just a huge adjustment for you to, like, let them go. And he's still very defensive about it. But I also like that they don't explain, like, oh, our mom died when we were 7 and I've raised her ever since. Yeah. Like, they don't feel the need to get too deep into the weeds about that, because it lets you, the movie is all about taking stuff at face value.
We didn't get to one of my favorite moments of this entire film, and I have a lot of them, but Rocky asks Adrian how she liked hearing her name on TV, and as he leaves, he makes a point of telling her that when he said that the stuff on TV Paulo said didn't bother him, he was lying. It actually did. What an admission. And this is another reason why I think Stallone just gives a pretty great performance.
This is such a good pivotal moment. And there's a couple of these where it stops to really explore what he's going through that he nails so good and are so fantastic. And you're right, this is one of them.
Yeah, I like that it's his initial decline, you could argue, is kind of out of, like, masculine hubris. And it's slowly, like, they keep picking at him to where he eventually reneges on it, because it becomes more about personal pride than it does the monetary compensation that would come with it.
Rocky is getting more money from Grasso to help with training expenses, and he says that he'll be ringside for the fight. We then cut to Mickey on the stairs, and he's coming by Rocky's place asking to train him. What's weird about this is Mickey isn't here out of the goodness of his heart. He's here because he sees it as his last good shot at glory, and Rocky is seeing through this. And after a bit of yelling at one another, Mickey leaves, and we see Rocky run to him and comfort him with words we never hear. I love the choice that Avildsen makes to not show or tell us what was said between the two of them. Another scene, it's just a nice evolution, and this is what probably got Meredith the nomination, right, Matt?
I think this was the clip they would have played if they actually played clips back in the 70s.
Yes.
But I also like that Rocky kind of gains a surrogate father figure without being preoccupied with him actively looking for one. Like, we don't know Rocky's backstory or his upbringing because it's not important in the context of this story.
Yeah, and I mean, Mickey's not that great of a guy. Like, Mickey's trying to, he's in this for himself. I mean, he thinks he can help Rock, and he's right. But this is for him as well. You know, he's kind of just an opportunist with this. And I love that these two have got what feels like probably 12 to 15 years of shit coming out between them. You know, it's a really good scene. I love when Rocky thinks that Mickey is left. So he comes out of the bathroom and then sees that he's still there. So kind of like hides right back in it. You know, it's just cool little stuff like that is really, really well done. This is just one of those powerful moments. And it's shot really well. It's blocked really well. Just superb.
You know what I noticed this time, boys? It's something I've never noticed in the 20 plus times I've seen this movie before. Stallone must have been living in a real smelly situation because scent comes up a lot in this movie. Like, we're having Apollo say, "Be a thinker, not a stinker." Fucking Rocky yells about things stinking at least 3 times in this movie. It's just something that didn't get by me this time in watching the film and taking notes on it. So we see Rocky wake up and he has some eggs in the glass, something that I know I tried once and I think I threw up.
Yeah, this caused more people to get salmonella than bubonic plague.
Not advised. Rocky then does some exercises and goes for a little jog. And the thing to pay attention to here is that Rocky cannot make it up the steps. How they were able to keep this camera steady while going up these steps, I will never know. But Rocky's confidence isn't even close to where it needs to be. And his not being able to do this is such a thing that really resonates within the context of this movie.
Okay, so if his inability to throw a jab is the second biggest or the biggest issue I have with this movie, the second biggest is that this is a world where people can run in Chuck Taylors. Because those shoes are not designed for you to run in them. They hurt to walk in. They offer no arch support, so the fact that he's the toughest son of a bitch in the world because he runs a freaking full-fledged 5K in those and runs upstairs in them, and I'm like, I trip and break my ankle when trying to leave my house stairs wearing those damn things.
Matt, they can't even afford anything in this movie, and you're getting mad at the shoes?
Oh, it just drives, but like, it's a fun nitpick because those shoes are not designed for running.
Oh my God, no, forget that. Matt just brought me back to the last time I bought a pair of those because I remembered how cool they looked, and then I went for a walk.
You wore them to school, and that was it.
Oh, man.
Like, gym class, forget it.
Skateboard shoes, and that is it. Yeah, I do think it is so important to pay attention that he's got such a hard time getting up these stairs. Look, he's getting up. He's doing what he's got to do. I did those eggs like that once. After that, I scrambled my egg whites, but it shows the progression of him and what he can do. And it's, man, it's brilliant filmmaking. It really is.
I think Matt's right. I think more salmonella was caused by this fucking scene than anything. Because I think just two to three of us on this podcast tried it. I can imagine how many people did. We see Rocky walking through a meat locker with Polly. And I love Rocky's just touching the slab of meat and just going, moo. That always makes me laugh. Polly's asking for a job, as always, as well as asking how Rocky's getting along with his sister, and even asks if he's stumping her. Rocky says that he's going to leave, and after telling Polly he has a big mouth, Polly hits some meat out of frustration, and this causes Rocky to just unload on it, and it's not out of some necessity to train, it's out of anger. And I love Polly's response to this. He goes, "If you do that to Apollo Creed, they'll put us in jail for murder." Famous scene, right, Adam?
I mean, it's iconic as it gets, and I think most people forget that he didn't bring him there to train. It just happened by getting in an argument with Polly, you know, and then it turned into that. But really good scene. I'd love that he did this so much in real life that he now has flat knuckles.
Yeah.
People think about Rocky, they think about hitting the meat.
Yep.
I'm sorry. I realized it as it came out.
So Adrian wraps his hands up, and when she tries fooling around, Rocky says that he can't fool around during training. He needs to stay strong because, as me and Adam both know, women weaken legs.
Okay, so I'm watching when I'm watching this. Laura's in the other room. She's working, but it's loud enough that she can hear. And this scene comes up, and I think it's actually later on when he talks about Mickey, like, yells at him about women weaken legs. She looks at me, and I'm like, every one of us get told. Women, I go, every boy that's played high school sports onward get told women weaken legs and don't do it. She's like, are you serious? I'm like, yep, that is 100% true.
Absolutely.
But I gotta say, I like this evolution of Adrian. She's coming on to him. She feels comfortable with him and she wants to make him feel better. And I don't mean that as a, oh, that's the only way to make your man feel better. She wants this. She's like, you feel their relationship evolving. And I love that little moment.
So Rocky apologizes to her and embraces her, and he's really having to get used to this way of life. He is taking this fight seriously, and he's having a hard time adjusting to that. And that kind of goes what Adam was just saying, in that, look, she's coming on to him, but he can't do anything about it. So Rocky starts going after the heavy bag, and Mickey ties his feet together to teach him balance. And I love Mickey just yelling at everybody who approaches him. Like, this fucking character, grumpy as hell.
Yeah, I like how he's acting like the bodyguards to combat paparazzi when celebrities are walking around. The glorified bouncer.
Rocky is running the streets in this black leather jacket as he spots Adrian in some new wardrobe, and Rocky has nothing but compliments for her. And this is when she shows him her gift to him, Buckus the dog. Rocky then spots a news van, and Polly says that he doesn't know why they're here before disclosing that he brought them here to watch him train. Jesus Christ. Oh, this fucking character. It's only the first movie. Polly brings Rocky in, and we see him once again pounding on this meat. And I do love the scene of Tony watching Rocky do this. And we see that he's starting to get concerned. But Apollo, he's just concerned with the business end of the fight, not paying attention to how his opponent is training. This is a great scene, and it's a reason why I really enjoyed Duke the character.
Yeah, things just like this. He's just like, yo, champ, you need to watch this white boy fight. It's like, nah, it's all good. His team is starting to realize this isn't just a show. Apollo is over it. Little moments help fill this out.
Yeah, I like that. It's like that guy who keeps warning that the end day is going to come. You just keep brushing him off. It's fine. What's another couple hundred years going to do? But I like that he's overconfident, and we'll talk about this in the actual resolution, but not enough to where he doesn't win the fight. Like, they walk a very fine balance. To where he's overconfident without being ignorant.
We then see another one of Paulie's tantrums, and this is the one that causes Adrian to finally ask Rocky if he needs a roommate. And this is happening on Christmas, and we all know that this is when the most fights of this nature happen. Is on
Second only to Thanksgiving. That's why this movie came out in November.
Yeah, exactly.
it's a preview of fights to come.
Yes.
Yeah, what's Christmas without a family member pulling out a bat and breaking some shit in the house?
Play on Christmas.
We go back to the gym as Mickey is training Rocky, telling him that he's going to eat lightning and crap thunder. Another one of my favorite lines of this. He then introduces Rocky to the Cut Man, who will definitely earn his way as this series goes on.
To be fair, if you eat enough Philly cheesesteaks, you will crap thunder.
Paulie comes in and asks to talk to Rocky, asking if he can make some money off Rocky's name. Every time I mention Paul, it's always about getting a job or making money off of him.
He's asking. He's a hustler.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? Say what you will. Paulie works for us. Paulie's trying.
We didn't get a training montage. Get used to these boys.
Oh, boy. That's the subhead of these movies. Yes. Rocky 1, the montage. Rocky 2, another montage.
Although
Rocky 3. Okay, stop it, please.
Rocky 4, where's the movie?
You know, Rocky 4, insert movie here.
Yeah. Although, you know what? This one has a purpose, because at the very end, he's able to make it up these steps. And this is when his confidence soars. And in his eyes, if he can do this, he can do anything. It is a huge moment in this movie and franchise that I'm never going to stop talking or thinking about. And you can see that in his eyes, which is another reason I'm giving Stallone all the credit for his performance. Matt, you've already mentioned that these steps have really become tiresome to you, but what do you think about them in this scene?
No, I don't think they're tiresome. I just think this is The Exorcist. Like, you have people falling downstairs. This one, you have people falling upstairs trying to climb them. Now, the thing also to know, like, montages as we know them were not much of a thing in the 70s when you were making movies. I mean, great, you had, like, Citizen Kane, which had a montage of all of, like, Kane's expensive items. And then you get to the fire with the sled that's being burned. But that's nowhere near as complex. Like, this kind of started, in a lot of ways, the further use of montages, to where the point where they're written as jokes in a lot of sports movies. They're obligatory in the same way that a Bond movie needs the cold open and a theme song. And The montages you got around this time were at the end of movies.
Yeah.
Like the big baptism in The Godfather. That's the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. You get the big montage of death. And you got like a lot of prologues, like the 2001 with the bone. That's technically a montage. Adam, although I doubt Stanley Kubrick ever watched a Rocky movie. I highly doubt he gave enough of a shit to check those out. Because, I mean, look, we live in a world where Christopher Nolan loves it Fast and Furious. Maybe Kubrick did like Rocky.
And Rambo. You never know. Adam, how do you feel about this, sir?
I think this is a montage that fits the movie that it's being told. I think it's much less campy than what we're going to get later on, you know, obviously. And the culmination of it with him easily bounding up those steps in triumph, it makes you want to get up and go running. I mean, I don't, but it makes you want to go. And, you know, this is the kind of montage that fits right, not the type that, you know, gets parried in a South Park episode. So this, yeah.
Yeah, so much so that this franchise parodies montages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We see Rocky get up and go to the arena where the fight is taking place. And the promoter, Juergens, is asking what he's doing here. And I love Rocky's response. He's worried because they got his color scheme on the poster wrong, which, by the way, was an actual thing that happened. But instead of, like, redoing it, because that would cost money, they just wrote the scene as a compensation, which I thought was really well done.
I also like the contrast. The poster for this movie, it's black and white. It's monochromatic.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because Apollo, all his marketing is flash and red, white, and blue. Just, you know, it's like Uncle Sam coming in your face for all intents and purposes. But Rocky, it's all bare bones and just even his tights. It's the bare essentials. It's important to his character. He's not flash. And you could argue he's not much substance either because he's such a simple guy.
Yeah. Great shot of the scope of the arena. And we're seeing exactly what he's getting into here.
I like that it sets up the promoter. He says something here. We're just like, it doesn't really matter, does it? Like, it's a show. You know, hey, you're here to make Apollo some money, you know, and we're going to give you a little bit. Nobody cares what you look like. Nobody cares that your poster is wrong. Nobody cares that you're here. And this scene being just another one where, because they screwed up on the prop, that they're going to write some extra lines and it matters to the way this movie fits. It's brilliant.
Oh, boy. Here we go. So
also before that, like, it's, you know, the Spectrum is gone now. It's kind of in the same way that this franchise, you know, it's still going, but the Spectrum that closed, like, what, 2010?
Around there.
Something like that. Yeah.
Not just closed, they demolished it.
Completely. Yeah, they demolished it.
Who would have thought Pearl Jam would have caused an entire arena to be. But I guess when you're a trash bag franchise like the Philadelphia Flyers, or the 76ers for that matter, I guess that place should be burned and condemned. Yeah. Maybe it brought bad luck.
We then, oh boy. Here we go. We didn't get the other scene that makes up the theme of this entire movie. So Rocky gets home and reveals to Adrian that he just doesn't think he has a chance of beating Apollo. All he wants to do is go the distance. And I gotta say, every single person has felt this way. And that's why this movie means so much to so many people, including me. We've all felt that we can't get through the situations that life brings us. And if we go the distance and that bell rings with us still standing, we will know that we aren't just another bum from the neighborhood, as he says. Such a powerful scene, maybe the best acting Stallone will ever do.
One of the things I love about this, and it could be a trivia thing. It's like the, you know, who was the killer in Friday the 13th? You know, so many people mix up the ending of this film, except for those that know movies and those that are, think they're smart, yada, yada, yada. His goal is different than what everybody else's goal would assume it is. That's what's great. He has his own goal for this, and it's not winning, but it's still what nobody else has done. And that's amazing. And that he's confiding in Adrian this way, that he's horizontal, the film is still shooting vertically, or technically horizontal, but, and Adrian's tucked behind him, trying to make him feel good. This is beautifully done. His emotion is great. Yeah, Stallone is great in this scene. And you could kind of feel that when he's writing this, I'm like, look, I don't need to have a blockbuster. I just want to make a movie. I want to make a movie that gets released. Like, you know what this is, and that's, using the boxing for it is fine, but this scene is really good. And it's one of the reasons I love this. It's not about winning. It is about setting a goal for yourself and completing it against all odds.
This scene's also important because it plays the hand that he's not going to win the fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's a cool bit of foreshadowing, but it also lets you realize that it answers the question, why is he not upset when he loses at the end? You know, he's not cussing out the refs like modern boxers, the judges like modern boxers do, because that's not where his priorities are. His priorities are like, I want to show that I'm worthy of being in the same ring as him rather than beating him.
the fact that producers and this studio wanted to cut this scene, it blows my mind that they could not see that this was the theme of the entire movie. And maybe they just saw this as a release on the calendar because nobody gave this movie a shot. But the fact that they couldn't see that, I just cannot imagine this movie without it. This series without this scene. It's what the series builds itself on. So I love seeing the prep work that these fighters are doing. And I remember watching this with my dad and asking him, why are they putting that stuff up their nose? What are they doing? Nice little... Matt, we talk about Taxi Driver. I like how when they get out there and Apollo's talking to Rocky, he's just like saying, is he talking to me? Complete Taxi Driver thing there. Big Apollo entrance, cameo by Smoking Joe Frazier. This has all the pomp and circumstance that you can get in the 70s fight.
Yeah, so much pomp and circumstance. Half expected the Macho Man to be walking him down to the ring.
I know.
Because, I mean, Macho Man wore that similar outfit to WrestleMania
7?
No, yeah, when he lost to was it when he lost to Warrior?
I think so.
Because one of the WrestleManias, he wore the red, white, and blue.
Yeah.
Very similar look. It had to have been because 8, he wore gold. Yeah, this is very, very, I couldn't stop thinking of Randy Savage while watching this.
Funny. What I like about this, though, is like it's showing just how much Apollo's not taking this serious. It's all about the show to him, you know?
Yeah. And he thinks this is going to be a walk in the park.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, look, it's nothing compared to what they can do now with all the pyro and shit. But still, like, you're coming out on this thing that's being carried, and you have this costume on, you're throwing money out to the crowd, you're wearing this wig. All of this really points to the fact that Apollo doesn't see this guy as anything other than a payday.
Right. And he's not. I mean, that's what he's picked for. You know, this is a showcase to boost Apollo for whatever Apollo's next match is going to be. It's not to be a legitimate fight. So Apollo's not wrong. He completely overlooks who Rocky is.
Well, this is sort of the boxing equivalent of The Longest Yard.
Oh, good call. Yeah.
When the whole point of that original movie and the remake is it's a tune-up game.
Mm-hmm.
And you're only here because you know the basics and you have experience. And that came out a couple years before this. So I just find that perspective very ironic and surprisingly similar.
I have to be honest, guys. Once this fight started, I kind of put my notes down and watched. It's something I've seen a lot, like all these original fights. But I will say, while it's not the most technically sound fight in the world, I still love it. I love how Apollo's dominating for the first set of minutes, and then Rocky just comes out of nowhere and knocks him down. And we're seeing it from the perspective of not only the arena, but we're seeing it from the TV point of view as we're looking at the bar where Rocky hangs out with and everybody's cheering. The fight's not technically sound, but I like it. Matt, you're really criticizing the technique in these movies. What do you think about this?
Well, what these fights lack in technical prowess, they make up for with entertainment and story. Like, these function as movies within a movie. You know, you have you start out slow, you have your inciting incident. In this case, it's Apollo being knocked down in the first round. That's like Janet Leigh getting killed in Psycho, where it's like, oh shit, that actually just happened. So the fight scenes function as three acts within the confines of a boxing movie, and that's why they work. It's like they're the film version of Hulk Hogan's wrestling at his peak. You didn't watch for the technical craftsmanship because he didn't really have much, quite frankly. You watched it because of the psychology and the amusement park ride ebbs and flows that come with it. And that's how I look at almost all of these fights to varying degrees. Now, some do get more technical than others, which we'll talk about. But the movie also, this is the blanket statement I want to make, it's really not a boxing movie. Mm-hmm. It's about boxing. But that's just the backdrop for the story being told.
Man, if he would have just went to that neutral corner, he would have won in the first round. Dude's dancing around the ring for like 12 seconds, and Apollo gets up at the count of 8. Jesus. Yeah, to Matt's point, this movie's not about boxing. It just uses that to tell the story. Because by the time this match starts, you got, what, 12 minutes left of the movie? And that includes credits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's more rounds than there are minutes of the movie.
You know, yeah. And we only see three full rounds. It's great. You know, is this... In this entire series, we can lampoon the fact that boxing is not done this way, that no ref, even back in the 70s, would allow these matches to go the way that these go. Nobody would not have stopped this fight. No doctor would have not have stopped this fight well before. That's not what this is about. So yeah, this is a dang good time. But even Apollo, when he clinches with him and locks him up, he's like, man, fight. We got to put on a show. you start to realize that these two are here for completely different reasons, but Apollo's still trying to do his job. You know, he's still like, you know, come on, man, give these people something.
These two did.
I thought he was about to pull a Shawn Michaels and throw a temper tantrum in the middle of the ring because the guy wasn't, you know, up to his self-perceived standard. But yeah, to Adam's all the other point, the State Athletic Commission would have filed a lawsuit after this movie.
I like how we're seeing the ring car girls, and like we're seeing Rocky for the first time in his life experience having his nose broken after bragging that he'd never had it happen.
In the first round.
Yes. It all cultivates in Apollo having his ribs completely busted up. And I love Mickey just telling Rocky to not let that bastard breathe when he goes out.
It just, oh, I remember though being the first time I understood what he was saying. Cut me, Mick.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I want to say the first, I don't know, a few times I watched this, especially as a young person, I didn't understand. That is to just, oh, man, to just cut that blister open and just let it go.
I didn't understand either.
No, it was such a violation of the rules of boxing. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. But, oh, man, that is just horrendous to think about.
The fight goes and goes until the bell rings that final time, and Conti's score tells us that it's over, and Rocky has accomplished his mission. No, he didn't win the fight, but he went the distance, and he got the girl. So in his eyes, he's a winner.
As they hug it out after that bell rings, ain't gonna be no rematch. Don't want one. Both of them have laid it all out there. Yeah, love it.
They tie the bow very tight there. That gets unwrapped within a set of months when this movie's out. But you know
I also like that they found a way for him to lose without being knocked out.
Yeah.
It's a split decision. It wasn't a unanimous decision. It wasn't a TKO. It was by a couple points.
What I like about it is it doesn't even matter.
Nope.
He has done it. You know, he has done his mission. The person who really cares about this decision is Apollo. Rocky himself, and maybe everybody else who is looking for a payday of this, Rocky does not give a shit about the decision. All he cares about is that woman. And let me tell you guys, man, I'm watching this movie, and I like to get up in the morning and watch them before Jen gets up, and I'm watching it, and she came out right at the final fight. She comes out. And yeah, we have seen it parodied 1,000 times, not 100 times, 1,000 times. Rocky yelling Adrian as they're trying to interview him. But I tell you, man, Jen came out, my eyes were watered. I was a mess. This gets me every time. It's a hell of a message to send at a time when this country wasn't thinking too positively. And that you have your goals, you set those goals, and you will be a better person no matter what anybody else thinks.
Yep, 2 for 2. You show me that scene with him yelling Adrian by itself, it doesn't do anything. You do it. When I'm watching this movie, when I'm watching their journey, I'm going to get glassy-eyed every frickin' time. Mm-hmm. Every movie for the first couple has some tear-jerking moments that get me. And I'll point them out as we do it. This is obviously in this one. I love that they are announcing the results in the background. Mm-hmm. And if you don't pay attention, you don't even know. You don't know. If you ask 90% of people, they're going to say, yeah, of course Rocky won. And he did, but he didn't win the fight. And it doesn't matter. You know, so I think so many people mix up the ending of Rocky 1 and 2. He won. And watching Adrian get through, watching her face, her coming up through, and even Paulie.
Yeah.
And Paulie lift to the... It is... God dang, I'm getting glassy. I'm thinking about it. It is such a beautiful moment. I love the way that it's done.
Paulie does the only redeeming thing in this entire movie.
Distracts security.
Yes! To let her in. Matt, I'm assuming this didn't get you as much as it got us.
No, but... I understand the staying power, but I will say there is a movie in this retro that broke me 3 times watching it.
Wow.
I'm not going to say which one it is. We'll certainly get to it, but I love that a movie that is all about a 1,000,000 to 1 and the underdog, it doesn't have the ending that you think it will. Yeah. Like, because the natural inclination is for him to defy the odds and win the fight, but they break from convention, but in a way it makes it even better that they didn't do that. There's so many movies that have tried to do this where it's like they, even sports movies, like Longest Yard. It's like, yeah, they kind of win, but he's still in prison. It's not like he's playing and he wins, he gets his sentence reduced, or like Poetry at Rhymes. Like, there's an entry in this series that tries to do this ending similarly.
Yeah. Again. I mean, Miracle on Ice, guess what? That wasn't the gold medal game. I mean, sometimes when you pay attention to what's going on, you realize reality's not what you think it is, and it's still just as special.
But it also gets by because, like I said, it's not about boxing. Like, the match is just the culmination of the story, which is, again, why this works. And that's the outcome doesn't matter to fans, but it matters to that guy who fought in the ring. That's why it works. At a time, to Garrett's point, we were fighting what we would find out was an unwinnable war around this time, and people were very distrusting of authority, and a lot of times people were looking for someone to fight just for something to do, because we needed a place to like target our self-doubt and something to overcome. And I think that's why this movie responded as well as it did, in that it's not a crowd pleaser ending in the conventional sense, but that doesn't matter.
Matt cried at the end of the Cold War in Rocky IV. I'm calling it right now.
I cried at Sue Me For What?
I did too. It's only because I paid money for it. One more thing I want to say before I get to our scores is this was supposed to end differently.
Mm-hmm.
It had originally ended with Rocky and Adrian walking out. If you've seen the black and white poster of this with Rocky and Adrian holding hands, that's pretty much the final image you see of this movie. And Stallone made the call that that's not what works. Actually, no, it was Athelson who made the call. We need to end it with them in the ring together. That was the right call. All right, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Rocky 1976? Adam.
Movie that is on so many people's lists of everything. A movie that's been parodied ad nauseum, that has been rebooticled, which is amazing. But a film that after 50 years is in that pantheon of films that is not only still watchable after that time, but still is resonant, still holds up, still is effective, and is captivating just as it was. The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, Star Wars, Taxi Driver, Jaws. So many things around this time are left indelible marks on cinema for a reason, and this is one of them. The, of course, underdog story of how this was written, how this was brought to screen, and the production and producers wanting to cut him out of it for a man that was trying to sell his dog because he couldn't afford dog food, but wouldn't sell this for the equivalent of $350,000, which would have been life-changing for a struggling actor, to hold on to it to make this is just an appetizer for the movie that it is. And after 50 years, if there was some bullshit to that, we would have learned it by this point, especially being that Stallone and Winkler, Irvin, not Henry, freaking despise each other at this point. Everything in this movie works. The writing is pretty damn superb. The casting is as good as any movie maybe has ever been, because this thing is filled out with people who make this feel real, make this feel natural, make this feel like people you know. Even if you don't like them, you know who they are. Talia Shire breaking away from the family people that she was with for so long to make this one, to establish herself. And this is as much of a star-making vehicle separating from Coppola as possible. Sylvester Stallone, obviously, it's a star-making vehicle because he's as star as it gets. Even the way this is shot, though, people seem to overlook that Avildsen brings a directing style to this that doesn't exist today. And it's absolutely beautiful from the colors, the angles, the mood, the depiction is amazing. Conti's music is iconic as today as it was 50 years ago. And that's absolutely amazing. You have to be in a mood for a 70s style movie, because this doesn't hold your hand. It just sits you down and say, let's experience this together. But it is a love story drama that is for the ages, that still works today, just as impactful, at least to me, as it is the first time that I saw and recognized what this movie is. The more I talk about it, the more I realized how much I love this film, and it is absolutely that amazing. I came in here saying that I'm giving it a 9, and I'm wrong, because I can't find something to bitch about other than Stallone, and even that would just be a cheap shot, because I do think he deserves the credit as well. I'm giving this a 10, and I say that, not even saying that this is my favorite one in this series, we'll discuss that later, but I do think this is one of those hallmarks of cinema that deserves it, so I'm giving it a 10 on 10.
Wow, that's your first 10 in probably at least a couple years.
Since Raiders,
yeah. All right, Matt, as somebody who despises boxing movies, what do you feel about Rocky?
No, I despise boxing as a sport movie.
Oh, too. Okay.
Because remember, I have a soft spot for plenty of boxing movies. But okay. I'm kicking myself for not giving this the proper time to like watch it and only telling people that I saw it because I knew it like the back of my hand. Because I think everyone knows this movie, even if they've never seen it. And a large part of that is because of the imitators, the references, the parodies, the way that some of the imagery has been plastered all across the landscape of this country and even the world, because this movie transcends like American sports, because it's got a human story behind it. And I think that's why it kind of stands in a tier in and of itself. But it's also why when we do like greatest sports movies of all time, I don't put this on that list, because to me, it's not a sports film. It's got boxing as the tapestry that this story is stitched on. And I'm going to be honest, there's not a lot for me to nitpick in this. If you've noticed, I've been extremely complimentary. And the only reason I'm not giving it a 10 is because it's just not one of my favorite movies. But I understand why so many people just unabashedly love this movie and why it has spawned the franchises, plural, that have come out of it. And the biggest compliment I can get for a movie that's 50 years old, it doesn't have that issue that a lot, even some of the best movies have with being dated or a little bit, you have to like recontextualize them because of how it was made at the time. Like that happens a lot with politics or social statements, but this movie doesn't have those things to overcome. So I'll give this a very, very, very high 9. I got to keep my 10s. Those are the brass knuckles I keep in my boxing glove when I need them, because it's just not my, I can't say it's not my cup of tea because I really, really love it, but it's just not one of my favorite movies, if that makes any sense. But find me a flaw in this, like a true technical flaw, and I will, you need to stop watching CinemaSins.
So 9 from Mr. Goudreau. You know, when I was a kid watching these movies, I would always skip this one because to me it wasn't the one with the action, right? It wasn't the one that hit my soft spot when I was that age. I was like, oh, I don't want to go through all the human drama just to get to a 6-minute fight or whatever it ends up being. Now I come to this and this is one that I really focus on. It's really hard to watch this movie and not think about the parody that Stallone eventually became in a lot of people's eyes. Yeah, he would redeem his career with stuff like Copland and things that proved that he could act. But for the longest time, he was known as the guy who was the Rocky guy. He was the guy who, every single time he stepped away from Rocky, with the possible exception of Cobra, maybe Tango and Cash, a lot of people have a soft spot for. But that's stuff that you have to be in the mood for. This to me, and Adam, I will disagree with you on one point, in that I could watch this in any mood I'm in and still fall in love with it. I am the same in thinking that this is a movie that just transcends cinema because of the underdog story surrounding it. And Matt, you made a really good point that I'd never thought about. This is sandwiched between two of the most important movies of all time. In that 3 years in the 70s where you had Jaws, you had this, and you had Star Wars. Those three movies right there just change cinema as we know it. And this is something that I will never stop loving. I don't care what Stallone ends up becoming. We will talk about it as we get deeper into this series. As I mentioned, Stallone becomes every single portion of the Rocky character that he portrays on screen. But I have so much love for this movie. I have so much love for the human aspect of this movie. I have so much love for the cast of this movie. I bring up to Jen all the time in that, you know, when we watch movies with villains, I tell her, I said, that guy must be a really nice person, because, and I found this when I was working out there too, the people who played the worst sons of bitches are usually the nicest of people. I would hope that Burt Young was the nicest person ever, because God, does he play an asshole so well in this. Everybody comes to play in this movie. John G. Avildsen, for God's sake, what a directing coup de grace to pull with this. He does some good things later on in his career. But if you're going to have a stamp put on Hollywood, this is definitely one to do. He will come back to the series, and we'll talk about that. But there's nothing I can criticize in this. There really isn't. If you've listened to me in this podcast, you'll hear I don't have anything really bad to say about it. So on that platform, I'm going to agree with Adam. I'm giving this a full 10 as well. And goddamn, Matt, you have put 3 series on the schedule this year, and all 3 have had at least one movie that made me cry. And this movie did that for me, and I almost did a little bit earlier in this podcast. It's a tremendous film that I can watch at any time.
But it's going to be 4 when we get the Saw later this year.
For different reasons. Oh, sometimes I love you so much. All right, so this movie becomes a franchise next week. We will discuss Rocky II next week. Came out 3 years later. Man, I was only 2 when it came out, so there's no sense of anticipation for it. But it made a shit ton of money. It did very well. Came out the same year as Jaws 2, ironically. I am anxious to revisit it because I haven't revisited it too often. Adam, what are you expecting when we discuss Rocky II next week?
Ooh, I think it's the one that's kind of forgotten the most, and I think that's unfortunate. I think it's going to be a heck of a discussion. I think we're going to discuss Stallone and how much he still brings to the franchise behind, you know, the typewriter, and how much that means. And yeah, I'm interested because it takes it from an amazing movie to a franchise. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Or is it just as good? And I think it's one of the ones that is talked about the least because of how much it has in common with this one. But I think it's very important, and I can't wait to discuss it.
Don't forget, he's not only behind the typewriter next week, he's also behind the camera. He's making his franchise debut as director. So that'll be interesting to discuss. Matt, what about you, sir?
Yeah, it's kind of I don't want to call it the black sheep because that's reserved for number five. This is a gray sheep because everyone talks about three and everyone talks about four. And people always are like, oh, yeah, that's right. There is a second one. And I'm always curious to why, because I'll say for the record, most of these movies I've only seen once. Two and five in the original series I've only seen once. And even the first Rocky I've only seen maybe twice in full. So I don't know these movies especially well, most of them. So I'm curious to go back to it because it's, you know, it's arguably you could subtitle it Rocky II Alternate Ending.
To be discussed next week. So many good things coming up this year. I'm so glad Matt has put this on the schedule. I think these are going to be tremendous discussions. I'm very proud of this one. So until next week, when we get to Rocky II, you stop this podcast, I'll kill you.
I never got a chance to thank Apollo for helping me out after Mickey died. But it's nothing compared to what you've done. You taught me how to fight again, and I'm going to go home and I'm going to fight this thing. But if I fight, I want you to fight too. I want you to go across this ring and knock that son of a bitch down. Can you do it?
Say it.
You're going to knock that son of a bitch down.
I know you are. You know why? Because you are Creed, and I love you, kid.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
See you next year. Thank God.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
It's already over.
You can toss them over till it's over.
What's that from, the 80s?
It's probably in the 70s.
Why you can? Don't get a sucker no statue. Give him guts. I told you I wasn't going away. You got your shot. Now give me mine.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as Star Wars, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, Indiana Jones, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the films in the Toy Story Universe, the Mission Impossible film series, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the Lethal Weapon films, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Mad Max film series, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Incredibles films, and so much more.
Rocky, got anything derogatory to say about the champ?
Derogatory? Yeah, he's great.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
And if you ever get hurt and you feel that you're going down, just lay
son of a bitch. But Mickey loves you.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
If you want to be the king of the beast and smell like a jungle rat, cat, they look a little like.
A 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, and Dave.
How did I do?
A little loud for my taste, but good. Oh yeah, very good.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Does this look like a circus to you, man?
Scheduling done by Matt.
You're one crazy old man. You're good, though.
The 3 Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
We love you, Ron!
Yeah, and I love you too.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
Will be a perfect example of how pathetically weak your society has become. We go.
On the Rocky Four made more than that's gonna be the highest grossing one. Yeah, we should take bets which one's the highest grossing one. It's probably
Montage the movie Rocky Four.
Yeah, good luck with that plot summary.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Music happens, people fight.
And we're... Well, that plus summary is going to be like two sentences. And, God, now we get to Creed 3. We're going to talk Jonathan Majors. Oh, my God. Okay.
We got a while.
Yeah. Rocky. Released November 20th, 1976. I'm sorry. Released December 3rd, 1976. I think he's really good in this. I'm going to take it a step higher than you guys. I think he's tremendous in this, actually.
I think he's good. I think he's good. I didn't see, like, best actor worthy. Yeah, I see the nomination, but I don't even know who won that year. I'll have to look it up.
It was Finch. It was Peter Finch from Network. Ended up winning.
Oh, that's right. You know, somewhere De Niro was going, how did I not win?
So Rocky is completely...
It's revealed in that Burgess Meredith, who is the... I don't know if he's the editor or whatever. He's revealed to be the devil. And that the guy made a literal deal with the devil to get success. I like that his casting is kind of a wink and a nod to that, where you're questioning what's his ulterior motive.
I don't remember that one. I don't think I ever saw that one.
So that's the last one. So the first good. One, the first good. One's where he's the bookworm.
Yes.
The second one, he's the guy who gets strength.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Mm-hmm. And then the third one is the librarian who gets sentenced to death.
I remember that one, too. Yeah, I never saw the other one. Wow.
Yeah, it's called Printer's Devil. I think it's, I don't know what season it is. If you just type in Burgess Meredith Devil, it'll come up.
Yeah.
We see Rocky go to the...
Yeah, what's Christmas without a family member pulling out a bat and breaking some shit in the house?
Play on Christmas. Or except January. One time in 2000 where my father got so drunk he puked all over a Vinny Testaverde jersey, was swearing at people, he was swearing at Parcells. That's a story for another day. But Christmas in Baltimore, 2000.
To depict the way that they do Apollo Creed.
I also like that he picks Rocky because of his nickname. Like yeah, we're he sees
to that.
The,
yeah. We haven't gotten to that. We haven't gotten to that yet. We're getting there. He hasn't picked him. So we go back to the gym as Mickey is training Rocky, telling him that he's going to eat lightning and crap thunder. Another one of my favorite lines of this. He then introduces Rocky to the Cut Man, who will definitely earn his way as this series goes on.
To be fair, if you eat enough Philly cheesesteaks, you will crap thunder. Especially with the spray the nacho cheese they use.
With cheese. Which,
yeah, cheese, it's like Cheese Whiz, but I like using, just slap some provolone or American on it, because I like it. It's less dense. You can taste the meat.
Paulie comes in and asks to... Can't wait to discuss Rocky 2 next week, and my God, there are so many quotes to pull from. I don't know which one to do. This whole series is going to have a fucking set of quotes that I'm going to have to choose. Okay, I got it. All right, so until next week, when we get to...
Bye, Paulie.
Goodbye, Rocco.